I'm joined on the line by the wonderful Will Anderson, host of ABC's Gruen Transfer and current star of his own one-man show. Would be bloody hard not to be, I suppose. Will versus Man. Will, how are you this morning?
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, it is hard to not be the star of your own one-man show, but often you still manage to be not the star of your own one-man show. Sometimes the audience member is the star of your one-man show. Sometimes something that just happened in the room that night is the star of your one-man show. You'd be amazed at the amount of times that people come up to you and the thing that they remember from the one-man show is a thing that never, ever happened on any other night.
Yes, it's amazing how one heckler or one witty comment from the audience can just trigger it into a different direction.
It was amazing. In fact, a show I did two nights ago, and they were a wonderful crowd, which I need to tell people really does make a difference. You know, I always talk about comedy as being we, and, you know, I haven't suddenly, you know, thought I was one of the royals and started using the royal we. I think of it as, you know, a shared experience between myself and the audience. So on the nights when the audience are reserved, they get the show that I prepared, you know, they get everything that I, you know, had intended to tell them, and I try to do it as best I can. But on the nights when the audience are really in the mood to have some fun, what you tend to get is the extra stuff. You get everything that I kind of prepared, but you also get, you know, the stuff that just happens in the moment. And to the point where on Saturday night when I was doing my show, I actually messed up a joke. I gave away the punchline, well, almost gave away the punchline of the joke well before, you know, where the reveal in the joke normally is. And the audience was so good that I thought, you know what, I'm going to see if I can, you know, restructure this joke in my head and make it work still. And not only did it work still, but it actually worked better than the other 70 times I've done that joke. And I never thought the joke was broken. I always thought the joke was fine. I was like, oh, yeah, that's not a bad joke. It does its job. And suddenly I realized that just by simply rewording it, it was actually going to be a much better joke. And now I kind of have regret that 70 lots of people have seen that joke in its original form, and I really do feel the need to find their email addresses and phone numbers and track them down and tell them the new version.
Oh, dear. That would be a wonderful way to do comedy. If you stuffed up, the audience went away, you could at least say, look, no, here it is in its better format. You can have it now via email. Does that make you feel better?
Yeah, that's right. And here's a couple of answers I came up to that heckler. I didn't have any on the spot, but I thought of a couple of really good ones on the way home in the car. Here they are.
Yes, unfortunately, the esprit de Scalier does not really cut it in comedy. Either you do it then, or you don't do it at all. But speaking of doing it, comedy is bloody hard work. People look at comedians and they go, oh yeah, easiest job in the world. Stand up, tell a few jokes, cash a check and bugger off. I can't see that being the case. I imagine that you have to work very hard to write material, that it doesn't just drop out of the sky.
I look at you, there's pros and cons in that argument. The first one I'll say is that in the grand scheme of hard jobs, it is not that hard a job. You know, you stand up, I stand on stage for an hour, I talk about things that I myself find interesting. There is no one else who gets to decide what my show's about. It is one of the very few areas in life where you can honestly have free expression. Like, you know, as long as I can make the topics funny, I am allowed to talk about whatever I want to talk about in whatever way I want to talk about it. So it's a beautiful job. And, I get to have a drink while I'm at work, which they don't let you do if you're a pilot. You know, you get people being interested in, you know, your life and talking to you and all those sort of things. So compared to, say, what my dad does for a living, he's a dairy farmer, and he's from, my brother is in the third generations of dairy farmers who've lived on the same road, and they get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to milk cows and then, you know, go to bed at 8 o'clock so they can get up and go around their watering. That's a hard job. You know, telling jokes on stage for an hour is not a hard job compared to that. But is the craft of doing stand-up comedy well difficult? Yes. The hardest thing about stand-up comedy is that the audience has a voracious appetite for new material. Like, you know, comedy is not like music where people come and they want to hear you do your old stuff. people always want to hear you do your new stuff. You know, you go to the Rolling Stones and you'll go and have a drink and go to the toilet when they're doing their new stuff and hope they get to the old stuff that you've actually come to see. Well, that's not the same with comedy. Nobody ever comes to your gigs and stands up the back and says, do Queer Miss Milk spelled backwards from, you know, 1999. They want to hear what new thoughts you have to say. So the hardest thing about comedy is always trying to come up with new material, produce material that's of a quality of your old material. And people tend to rely on the old material. The way that I say to people, the way I would describe it is like fashion. Old material is like an old pair of jeans that someone told you once that you look really good in, so you kept wearing them. And then they became the most comfortable pair of jeans that you have. But the truth is that eventually, if you keep wearing those pair of jeans, they look like a really old, dated pair of jeans. No matter how comfortable they feel, it's time for you to get a new pair of jeans and wear them in. Because that's, you know, you're a new person now. So I think that's the same with material. As soon as it starts to feel really, really comfortable, it's probably time to try to get some new material. And then you do have to try to work that in until it feels as comfortable as your old stuff.
Is it hard work, though, to craft a joke? Do you find yourself constantly honing them and going over them and saying, I can do better, I can do better? Or is it, that got a laugh, do I need to change this?
No, I can sit there particularly, I mean, the way that I put together a stand-up show, if anyone's interested in, and this is purely just my way, not, you know, there's no sort of, I don't think there's any set way, you know, I'm always of the belief that whatever works for you seems to be the best way to do it, but the way that I do it, the way that I've sort of settled into, which suits my, you know, sort of writing needs, is that I don't tend to, I think of a show as a whole year project, so I'll take about almost 3 months, but definitely at least 2 months, to write the show, to conceive and put together the show with the aim that I'll then tour it for 9 months. And so the first thing to do is I take about 6 weeks of what I would just call active thinking. And that's the time where I look at all the newspaper articles I've pulled out of the paper over the year that I thought might be interested in talking about. I'll read some books on topics that I might be interested in. I'll just do some research, and I'll just have a lot of time thinking about the things that I feel really passionate about. Because if I'm going to do this show for 9 months, and if I'm going to tell it 200 times, then it's got to be a topic that I'm interested in talking about every night of the year, because you can come up with an hour of things that an audience will find, you know, entertaining or diverting. But the bigger trick is coming up with an hour of things that I myself will still be engaged in, you know, after 200 shows. So that's what I tend to do straight away. Then I'll take like about a month of actually just writing, but I don't write with any direction. I just write on those topics. I riff. I just kind of try to open my brain and see what comes out. And then I'll take about another 4 weeks of just taking that material, very raw, very unstructured, onto stages, and just starting to see if I can work it into, you know, what you like more, you know, commonly termed jokes or routines or chunks, you know, of material. And a lot of that process is done on stage because I like it to evolve a bit more organically and go to places that I couldn't go to if I was just sitting behind, you know, my desk. But so that after that, I tend to settle on a show. I tend to settle on something that'll be the starting point of my show. Over the next 6 weeks, when the show's actually up and being done, it will change quite a lot from night to night as I'm trying to work, you know, where should this routine go? Is the energy in the right place? Does it need some more punchlines? Does it need less punchlines? Sometimes you need to clear out the clutter to make something work better. And so there's a lot of thought about sort of, I guess, content and process in those first 6 weeks. And then I get to a point normally where I'm pretty happy with what the show is. The show is pretty much as I hope it would be, and that, you know, there's probably only about 5 to 10 minutes each night that changes. Then what happens is I go, is done on stage. So I might be like, hey, maybe I could, you know, this character, maybe that character would work better if they were a bit more like this, or maybe that joke would work better if I slowed it down a little here and try to speed it up a little here. And so each night I'll just kind of take one bit of the show and muck around with it, kind of pull it apart and put it back together again and see if it works better. And that's, I guess, the process that keeps me constantly engaged. And you kind of constantly feel like you're fine-tuning the show. Sometimes you take a piece apart and you put it back together again and it works much better. And sometimes you take it apart and you put it back together again and you're like, oh, it's lost something of what it had originally, and you go back to what it was that you had. So it's a constant fine-tuning to see, yeah, how can I make this show work better from then on?
Now, you come from a family of dairy farmers. Was going into stand-up comedy an attempt to avoid getting up early, or was there more to it than that?
I think there was certainly part of it that was to avoid getting up early. I remember my dad thinking it was hilarious when I started doing breakfast radio in Australia, and I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get into the radio station, and Dad used to get up at 5 to go and milk the cow. And so he always thought that was quite ironic and hilarious that he could sleep in for an extra hour after I had to go to work. But I always loved comedy. Like, for me, I was one of those kids who got swept up in comedy. My insights into the world came through comedians. You know, like, when I was growing up, the people who I responded to were people saying things that I'd never heard before, but I instinctively felt like were true. And by that I mean people like George Carlin and Richard Pryor and Bill Hicks a little bit later on. These were people that I felt like really spoke to a truth about the world and a truth about humanity and human existence that, even as a teenage boy living on the road that my grandfather built, you know, on a farm, I was like, I've never heard these ideas. I've never had these conversations had around me, but I instinctively understand that this is the sort of stuff that also I want to talk about, and this is also the stuff that I want to debate, and this is often the stuff that I also believe. And so my insight into that world came through comedy. So I was in love with comedy. I never imagined that it would be something that I would be able to pursue as a living. I did not even know that it was something that you could pursue as a living. I didn't realize that comedy was a job. There was nobody that I'd ever met whose job was being a comedian. Like, it just didn't seem like that was a job. I didn't even know any actors, you know, or directors, or things that I at least knew were jobs that you could have. So I went off to university and I did a journalism degree because I was interested in, you know, news and current affairs and kind of how the world worked, I guess. You know, they were the things that drew me to comedy. And I worked as a journalist for a while and I just didn't enjoy it. And I got to a point in my life, you know, when I was 21, which seems, you know, so silly now, but at the time, you know, I felt like it was very old and that I had to make a major life decision. And my major life decision was that I wanted to be around comedy. Comedy was this thing that I loved, and I thought, well, why shouldn't I spend my life being around it? So I guess at that point I thought I was going to try it, but I also kind of just had the idea that I wanted to be around it. So if it didn't work out for me to be a comedian myself, I guess maybe I was thinking, well, if I try it, maybe I could, you know, do some comedy journalism. Or I could be a guy who wrote about comedy on a website, or I could maybe get involved in the industry in some way. I didn't really know at that stage what jobs were involved in the industry, but I figured there must be jobs involved in the industry, and maybe, you know, my skills were such that I could do one of those jobs. So that was kind of my initial ambition, and I tried it, and just, I mean, I guess like many people who try it, you know, if it goes well enough, it's very hard to do anything else for the rest of your life, because that feeling of connection that you get when you are alone on stage, armed with nothing but your thoughts, and you manage to keep a room full of strangers entertained, it's an incredibly intimate and powerful experience, you know. The interesting thing about comedy to me is that on your first day of doing comedy, you do exactly the same job as Richard Pryor does, as Billy Connolly does, as Dylan Moran does, as Louis C.K. does. You stand on stage alone with a microphone and your thoughts, and see if you can entertain people. Most jobs, they don't even let you use a photocopier by yourself on the first day. Comedy, they make you do the exact same job as the people who are best at it in the world on the first day. I mean, for less time, but it's still the same job. So it's an amazing introduction to that world, and just how difficult and exciting and rewarding it can be all at once.
Well, speaking of difficult and exciting, you're touring. You've toured America. You've been on Chelsea Lately with Chelsea Handler. Is taking an Australian act to America difficult? Is it hard to translate the ideas across, or is comedy becoming more universal?
Well, going overseas in general to work comes with its own problems and its own rewards. Like, I think comedy works very well, internationally, because comedy itself comes from an outsider's perspective. The great thing you're always trying to do as a comedian is look at something that people see every day and see it in a unique or different way. Have an insight into it that people perhaps inherently suspect, but they haven't necessarily verbally actualized. That's that great comedy expression when they say it's funny because it's true. What people really mean is it's funny because you have revealed a truth in something that we all secretly knew but hadn't kind of said out loud. And that's the best comedy. Being an international visitor to somewhere gives you that perspective. When you go to a new country, you can see things that they do every day, so they think are completely normal, but you, because you are a stranger to that land, see the absurdity in them. And if you can point that out in a humorous way, then people tend to respond to that very well. So I think you actually, in some ways, have great superpowers when you go overseas as a comedian, because you have the capacity to look at everything with fresh eyes. The weirder part of it is, of course, that you don't instinctively know how to reference things. It's very easy to just change a reference or change a perspective, but it takes years to live in something's culture to inherently understand why something is funny and why something is not funny. Who is off limits? What someone's backstory is, how people perceive that person. You can perceive someone in a very different way to how somebody who's grown up with that person, that celebrity, that politician in their culture might perceive them. So it's a lot harder to improvise on the spot, I think, when you're working overseas, because you're constantly worried that you might stumble into an area that, your perspective and the audience's perspectives are way off base from each other. But in general, I find it while it's a challenge, I find it can be a really, really rewarding challenge as well.
Speaking of rewarding challenges, the Gruen transfer is just that. It is something that I watch and it makes me think, and I see you on it, and you effortlessly talk about these products and commercials. I suppose it must be the background in journalism. You just come across as incredibly knowledgeable and incredibly funny at the same time. Even the little gags with the Coles hand, I found that to be just incredibly witty and well put together. But did you have a hand in creating the Gruen transfer, or did Zapruder just give you the tap and say, would you mind hosting this?
It was kind of a bit of both of those things in some ways. Andrew Denton was one of the people that I had grown up, really admiring on television. He used to do a show called The Money or the Gun, which was one of my favourite TV shows when I was a teenager. In fact, my two favourite Australian TV shows were The Money or the Gun with Andrew Denton and a show called The Big Gig, which was like a stand-up comedy variety show produced by a guy called Ted Robinson. And Ted Robinson ended up producing The Glass House, which was a show that I did at the ABC for a bunch of years, and he produces Good News Week, which was kind of the first TV show I really did a lot of in Australia. And so it was nice to have Ted, part of my life, and And the other person, obviously, that I'd really admired growing up was Andrew Denton. And Andrew came to me when Glass House finished, and we had lunch. And he actually just said to me, he said, "Will, I want to do a show about advertising that gives people the tools to understand advertising in the same way as the Australian TV show Frontline gave people the tools to understand current affairs shows." And I thought, well, that's a great idea. That sounds like, yeah, something that would be interesting. I said, yeah, what's the rest of the idea? What sort of show will it be? And he was like, well, I'm not really sure about that. Do you want to, you know, have a go and we'll see what we can put together? So the driving force behind the show in particular was a guy called John Casimir, as the producer of the show as well, and Andrew as well. But it really, it was quite collaborative from the very start. We did a series of workshops and, you know, we kind of made the show. The show became what it was. Originally, it was going to have a bunch of comedians on it. You know, then we decided we might use people from the advertising industry, and then we had to decide whether we wanted to play it serious, whether we wanted to do serious and funny, and what that sort of mix might be. And a lot of it grew organically around it. People always ask me about the show. They say, you know, like, what's your involvement? And I say, well, when it's on, it's pretty much a 5 to 6 day a week job. You know, I am there for the initial meeting. Our great researchers will decide some topics that we want to talk about, and our great researchers, and there's only a small team. There's less people in the Gruen team than there is in the Australian cricket team. So it's, they go off and they find a bunch of ads, and then we just sit there and watch them. And I genuinely just sit in the meeting and ask the questions about those ads that come to my mind. You know, whatever it is that I find curious or interesting or debatable, I just ask those questions. I come back 2 days later, John Casimir has turned all that into a script. All my stupid questions suddenly have become these amazing insights, and it feels like a TV show. So we have a run through the script. We kind of, you know, knock that down into a bit more shape, and then I put in the jokes. So, like, that's kind of my job, is I then go through sort of the outline that he's put there and sort of put in whatever jokes that are going to be in the actual script, which is the body of the show, because the show itself has a script. And when I say script, it only involves me. It's all the stuff that, if I'm ever staring straight into the camera and, you know, introducing a film clip, that was probably scripted. And then the rest of it's, you know, as people say on air, it's improvised. And so we get to that point, and then I guess then the research starts. So we've got 2 days to do research, basically. So if we're going to talk about banks, I've got 2 days to get over the entire Australian banking industry, you know which bank is earning what, how much they're spending on advertising, what the history of their... And so I cram for 2 days until all that stuff is top of mind. And then, basically, then it's filming day. So we... By the time I get to filming day, hopefully I have been so immersed in the process of, you know, how the show got put together and all the research that I instinctively know where to go, what to say, and, you know, where I can be funny so that I can just listen. Because the hardest thing about this show is if you are ever thinking about what you're going to throw to next, or... Because quite often I have to throw to a clip, or I have to, you know, but the conversation goes to places that we never would have imagined. So my job is to be constantly listening to go, all right, now I can bring it back to this, or now we can get onto this, or we better not get to there first, or shit, I better say something funny so that this doesn't get too dry and boring, or how can I make sure that this person's getting in because they're not getting in because they're getting talked over, and did he just say something that I should clarify, and I'm pretty sure what he said then was actually wrong, so maybe I need to put on the record that that was wrong, and oh yeah, I've got to get to a clip, and so all that stuff... It is, you need to feel very comfortable with it so that you can just trust yourself to listen and react. Because if you're trying to get to a joke you're prepared, or if you're trying to wedge in some idea that you thought of, it just doesn't work. And early on in the first couple of series, that's definitely, there was a lot more of that clunkiness, whereas now I guess I just trust myself by the time I get to show day. That, like, I work without notes. I don't ever use notes for the show anymore. I use notes in the first couple of series, but I've gone a couple of series without notes now, and I just try to do it all in my head and make it all make sense in my head, because for me, it just works better if I trust myself. I want to talk to a Steve Waugh, the Australian cricket captain, about facing the West Indies bowling and cricket, and I said, if they're bowling at 170 kilometres an hour, how do you have the time to make the decision of what shot that you're going to play? And he said, you don't. He said, you train. He said, you train and you train and you train. And then when you go out on the field, you trust that your instincts will know what to do and make the right decision in the right moment. And that's as close an analogy as I can find to trying to do what I do well. Is it train, train, train. Make sure that you've covered off every area. You've been in the show all week. You inherently understand what we're trying to get out of it at the end. And then just trust your instincts and just go with it when you think you're going to be funny. Go with it when you think you've got to be serious and try to do your best. And the truth of it is, like last week, so our first episode that went up, I was really happy with, and we probably could have put another 20 minutes in that we cut out that would have been equally as good. But second weekend, I'd had a bunch of extra commitments, and I didn't feel like I was as cross the show as I normally would be. And people might not be able to tell it on the TV, but I could tell it on the night. There was a couple of times in conversations where I was like, I'm not really sure what they're talking about. And there was a couple of times in conversations where I kind of missed where the joke should have been, or forced a joke where a joke shouldn't have been. And that's purely just that I felt like I hadn't 100% been prepared for that show in the way that I should have been. So it's all preparation, as sad as it sounds, and as much as, I think it was Graham Kenny, the great Australian TV host, who says you've got to prepare a lot to be this good at improvising, and sometimes it feels like that.
So it's a lot of hard work to be effortless. It's not as easy as it looks, obviously.
But yeah, that's exactly right, and I think it's on the weeks when you haven't done the hard work that people can see the effort. Mm-hmm. When you have done the hard work, you're right, it can look effortless, and that's eventually what you're looking for. You know, part of the reason that people think that stand-up comedy is easy is that the best stand-up comedians make stand-up comedy look easy. But that shouldn't be confused with the fact that it is easy. In fact, most of the people who make it look really easy work very hard to make it look that easy.
Speaking of working hard, you've got Gruen Transfer on at the moment. You're on tour in Sydney and coming up to Perth. But what's next for you, Will?
It's an interesting question. I always have a whole bunch of things that I would love to get to. People are always like, do you go on a holiday? And I'm like, I would, but then I'd sit around on the beach thinking I could be doing all those things that I'd wanted to do. I have a list of, I have an idea for a movie, and I have an idea for a comic book, and I have an idea for a serious book and another funny book. And somebody just asked me to write a short play for the Short, Fast and Loud Sydney Theatre Festival. And I thought, well, I've always wanted to write a play. Maybe running a short play would be a fun idea. And my friend Charlie and I do our podcast, Tofop, 30 Odd for the Pod, and it's ridiculous and nonsensical, but we love doing that, and we're kind of hoping that, it's funny, of all the things that I do, it's the only one that costs me money. There are a couple of things I do for free. That's the only one that costs me money, because, of course, as you know, it costs a little bit of money to just, put a podcast up and get the equipment and put together a website, and we make no money out of it. We just do it for free, and yet in some ways it's the most fun project that I do, and possibly because of that, because it exists for no other reason than it exists, that we think it's fun, it has no rules, and that's fun. So I'd like the opportunity to do more of that stuff as well. I always have a million things that I'd love to get to, and it's increasingly obvious to me that at 37 years of age that I am probably statistically closer now to the end of my life than I am to the start of my life. Probably, slap bang in the middle, to be honest. But let's just say that's the case. I suddenly realised that my capacity of time to get all these things that I wanted to do done is, you know, kind of running out. So I always think that it would be nice to slow down. It would be nice to take a little bit more time. But then I think, you know, you can take all your time when you're 65 and no one wants to talk to you. You know, people seem to be interested in, you know, letting me have the opportunities to pursue things that I want to pursue right now. So I'm going to try to take advantage of that as much as I can while people are interested. And then, you know, there'll be a point where people are not interested anymore, and maybe then I can take the time to pursue some of those other things.
Well, speaking of people being interested in you, if people want to find out more about your show or tour dates or 30-odd foot of pod, where can they go?
Yeah, look, the best place is Will Anderson. That's Will with one L, willanderson.com.au, my semi-regularly updated website. The best thing to do is go to that website and then just follow the links to actually Twitter or Facebook or you know, any of the websites that actually relate to the projects that you do enjoy. Because I'm most often on Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. But if you want to find all those links, Will Anderson, Will with one L, willanderson.com.au.
Well, Will, look, it has been lovely talking to you this morning. I feel like I've been taking you away from far more pressing things, but it has been fantastic that you took time out to talk to us today.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for talking to me.